And then we had a large group instruction from Josh on the exegetical leg, which is really structure, the organization of my material. You know, Mortimer Adler would have said you can't really analyze the text until you actually know how it's organized. You can't evaluate something till you understand what is being said, how it's being said, wrestling then with why it's being said. But once you see what is said and how it is said, then you can begin to actually apprehend why something is there. And so that structure talk, that organization talk, is a critical step. It's usually the first thing I do as well. He said it's the first thing he does in the week. It's the first thing I do as well. I sit down and we'll just hammer out on a little piece of paper the word structure at the top, and I'll say, okay, what kind of material am I reading this week? I'm in discourse. What are the strategic tools I need to put in my hands to kind of see what's being said and how it's being said? And I'm thinking of main subject and verb. I'm thinking of connecting words that show the logical progression. I'm thinking of imperatives, and I get some of those bones out there, and then I start to maybe think about how they come back together. But I want to get the shape. I basically want to get the shape. And then when that's done, I get out another little piece of paper. All my work I do on paper like this. I don't use my laptop. I could care less how you work. But I work, I don't have a desk in my office either. I hate desks. Why do you want a desk? I mean, I did this school for like 16 years, 20 years. I don't want to see another desk as long as I live. So if you come into my office, a couple of really nice, comfortable chairs, be an ottoman, and I'll put the paper there and my Bible in front of me, and I can kind of work like that. But I'm now thinking context. That's the next thing I do. So it might be Tuesday, 10:30. I've got a lunch appointment. I'm thinking about sermon prep. Too many of us have no plan for sermon prep. We just open the Bible, we read 8,000 commentaries, our mind wanders around, we write down all kinds of notes, but we don't have an actual plan to prepare. And I'm going to say, okay, I'm going to give myself to another tool. Now that I have a sense of the shape, early in the week, possibly even what the emphasis is, now I'm going to say, well, how might context inform my understanding of this text? And for that, let's play a little game. You're the crazy uncle. You have a sister who has a daughter, therefore she is your niece. Your niece is 11 years old, attends the public school in your community. You're visiting your sister, you're over late afternoon, her daughter comes home and says, crazy uncle, I just got the part for Juliet in our school play. You're like, that is so great, sweetie. Give me your best line. So she says, Romeo, O Romeo, wherefore art thou, O Romeo? You, of course, being the crazy uncle and a pastor to beat, look at her and go, you know, I speak publicly week by week, and let me help you a little bit. When you go back to school tomorrow, you got to put your whole self into that line. So maybe do it like this. Romeo, O Romeo, wherefore art thou, O Romeo? Your niece, because she loves you, goes back to school the next day, performs the line exactly as you indicated, comes home in tears. Your sister calls you to come over. Your niece looks at you and says, I'm not doing too well. And you say, what's the matter, sweetie? And she said, well, you know, I told you 2 days ago that I had gotten the role of Juliet in the school play, and then I went back yesterday and I did the line exactly the way you said it, and today she told me that she's giving the line to somebody else. Tell the guy next to you, what did you do wrong? All right. We got any English majors in the crowd? Got any lit majors? What do we got? What did you do wrong?
Why?
Go ahead.
Wherefore?
Wherefore does not mean where. It means why. Yeah, that's a key concept, isn't it? Wherefore, in Old English, is not where art thou? It's why art thou called Romeo? Act two, scene two. You would have known not to tell your niece to do that if you had just read the very next line, which reads, from Juliet, deny thy father and refuse thy name. Or if thou wilt not, be but sworn, my love, and I'll no longer be a Capulet. Tis but thy name that is my enemy. What'd you do wrong? You didn't take those words in what? In context. Context. Which is why when we preach words, we will have a better job of being both faithful and fruitful if we actually allow the context to control their meaning. I got a picture for it. This one's not published yet. I'm kind of working on it. I kind of like this one, but everywhere I give it, people seem to really hate it. But hey, maybe you'll be a different crowd. Okay, tell the guy next to you, what is that? Just tell the guy next to you, what is that? You can see, this is a rough draw. I'm workshopping this drawing. Tell the guy next to you, what is that? Anybody? Have you got something?
Is it a wedding ring?
It's a wedding ring. It's a ring. Man. It's a diamond ring. I must be getting a little better. Let's start. Hold on now. Let's see what happens on that. That's my picture for context. Let me explain it. Just as every precious stone is set, that is, it is fixed, that is, it is held fast in ways that put the beauty of the stone on display. So too, every text is set, it is fixed, it is held fast within the prongs of context, which then allow the beauty and the fullness of that text to be put on display. Now here's a thing for preachers. We need to do a better job not only of knowing what context is, but what use to make of context. Because we're very confused on what it is, and we're very inadequate on what use we make of it. Let's wrestle with that for a moment. If you wanted another drawing, I could have given you this one, which is railroad tracks. Context actually provides the rails upon which your text runs. It's what keeps you from going off the rails. It's what keeps you from being the crazy uncle in the pulpit. Context provides the rails upon which your text runs. Now, I said that we're kind of confused on what context is. So when you think of context, and the worksheet might help you a little bit, talk to your neighbor. When the Simeon Trust uses context, what do we mean? Just see if you can rehearse that with the guy next to you. It shouldn't be hard to do. We've given you on paper. All right, what do we got? Somebody give me one, just shout out one. Somebody shout one out.
Literary.
Literary context. Somebody give me another one?
Cultural.
Somebody give me another one?
Historical.
And somebody give me the final one?
Biblical.
Now, let me take 4 minutes to see if I can define these in ways that might help your small group, because we all use these in a variety of ways, but I'm going to try to use them with some particular meaning. By literary context, we mean that your text is set within a larger literary unit. In other words, it has a previous literary context, the stuff, the words, the argument being made up to your point, and it has a following context, a preceding and a following context, that is, the words, the stuff, the argument that is being made in light of your text. So I like this little thing here. Shorthand, it's the stuff on either side of your text. The literary stuff. Now watch this little app here. I like this. It could be, oh yeah, it could be the immediate paragraph or so in front of your text. It could be, oh man, oh, it could be the immediate paragraph after your text. But it could also stretch out, right? It could stretch out all the way to the beginning. It could stretch out all the way to the beginning of your letter. It could stretch out all the way to the end of your letter. That's fascinating. In 2 Timothy, this is for us though, literary context could go to 1 Timothy because it's a book of pairings. A lot of the books in the Bible are part of a larger literary unit. Just think of a few of them. 1 and 2 Kings, 1 and 2 Chronicles, 1 and 2 Corinthians. So if I'm in 2 Corinthians, 1 Corinthians I might think is biblical context because it's somewhere else in the Bible, but it's actually part of this literary unit of the Corinthian correspondence. So if you're in the material of 2 Timothy, we would say this week that literary context could apply to 1 and 2 Timothy. Now, some people take it even further. It's a grouping of material in the pastorals. You know, they walk it out like that. But let's just kind of keep it tight like that, literary context. You gave us another one, though, and you gave us cultural context. What do we mean by cultural context? Well, cultural context are specific details in your text that would have been known by the people in your text, but not necessarily by those to whom the text was written, nor by those to whom you preach. All right, let's slow that down. Cultural context, particular cultural details in the text known by the characters, the people in the text, but not necessarily known by those to whom the text was written, nor those to whom you preach. So you find the writers deal with this kind of thing in different ways. So you read Jonah 1, God says to him, go to where? Nineveh. It's a cultural detail. Jonah's called to go to a particular place, and the people in that text at that time, Jonah himself, had certain associations with Nineveh that weren't necessarily known by those who would first be reading the book. They may have been, but may not. And they might not be known by the people to whom you preach. So when he says go to Nineveh, your people might need to be explained by you the cultural significance of Nineveh and known as Jonah's calling to go there of all places. See what I'm saying? That's cultural context. In John's gospel, Jesus says to the woman, give me a drink, which in the text, the woman had no problem with. You know, she had no problem with this, but what he wants to say, what your listener is going to have a big problem with that. You patriarchal, Baptist, leaning, crazy man, pulpiteer, the man asks the woman to give him a drink, and all this gender stuff comes into play because you're dealing with university students who can't believe that Jesus lays there lounging by the side telling a woman, come on over here and give me a drink. Well, actually, John's aware that his readers might not know the cultural significance of the word, which was really stunningly open to her because it was so unusual for a man to speak to her. He wasn't patriarchal to her. He was actually breaking down all patriarchal and national lines with it. So he explains that to the reader in his parentheses. But that's cultural context. Give me another one. It was historical. What do we mean by historical? If literary context is the stuff on either side of your text, if cultural context are details known by those in your text, then historical context is the circumstance or the situation of those to whom your text was written. That's our definition of the audience and the audience. So historical context in 2 Timothy would refer primarily then to Paul's situation and circumstances, he's the author, and the historical situation and circumstances of Timothy to whom it was written. That's historical context. Biblical context, and I'm just kind of getting these out so that we can talk more informed, because you're going to look at your sheet this week, and you're going to look at your neighbor's sheets this week, and you're going to like, we're not defining these things the way they are. And that's fine. We'll just keep workshopping this till we get a rhythm of how to use this. Biblical context refers to citations or allusions in your text that were intentionally put there by the author for a particular reason. Biblical context is not simply stuff in your text that you find other places in the Bible. You know, I see faith here, and I also saw faith back in Genesis 15. So therefore, biblical context, he has the genuine faith here. Biblical context, I can also talk about Abraham's faith in Genesis 15. No, but when Paul quotes Genesis 15 and says it was reckoned to him by faith, he is setting in his literature a citation or allusion from previously inscripturated text. So remember, biblical theology is, in a sense, how does the Bible use my text? But biblical context is, how is my text making particular use of the Bible by design in the author? So biblical context is citations and allusions in the text that refer to previous inscripturated text, which is why biblical context, it would be impossible to refer to something that hadn't yet been written, because the writer is not drawing upon anything that hadn't yet been written. So just because you see something, let's say, in Matthew's gospel, that doesn't necessarily mean that biblical context, I can go all the way over here to a Pauline epistle. No, because Matthew's gospel wouldn't have been drawing on any Pauline literature. But if I'm in Matthew's gospel and he draws upon Psalm 44, that's biblical context. Those are the way you look at it. Literary context, stuff on either side of my text. Cultural context, cultural details in the text known by those in the text. Historical context, the situation or circumstances of the author or the audience, the ones to whom the text was written. Biblical context, intentionally selected citations or allusion in my text that my writer is making use of for some particular reason. Any questions on those definitions? Yeah, so, well, it could be an allusion. I mean, so he's referencing a point. You'll workshop this down the road. Did you get that text for an assignment?
I got that text.
Yeah, I'm not answering your question then. He's trying to preload my answer into a text he's got to deliver in his workshop. No, that's not happening. No, but to your point, there is a moment in 2 Timothy where there's a citation and most likely an allusion, and there's actually another allusion there that you haven't picked up on yet, so you'll have to start looking that for that as well. But at any rate, there is a moment where the author is drawing upon previously inscripturated text. You're going to want to note that, understand where it is, and then really know to what end. Why is he using that? Yeah. And then you'll know how I use it in my sermon. Yep. Any more questions? Joe.
Do you have any tools you could recommend to help us spot more allusion
Yeah, so there's a couple of things that would be really helpful to you in the New Testament. If you want to know the use of the Old Testament in the New, by Carson and Beale's commentary on the Old Testament use in the New. It's this fat. And any time I'm studying a New Testament text, I'm just looking at their index, and I will see what Don Carson and Greg Beale think are all the citations and allusions referenced. What you do with them, that's up to you. You might have an NA28, a Nestle Island NA28 at the back of that. That's the little blue Greek New Testament. They have an appendix where you see Nestle and Alon's understanding of what they think are the citations and allusions. Those are a couple of speed helps, and you need to use that. Otherwise, we're requiring you to know everything about the Bible. So I can get to biblical context every week efficiently on knowing whether there's anything I need to look up just by 3 minutes of looking at an appendix. And then I'll write those down on my biblical context sheet, and then I'll go back and look them up to see how important or not I think they might be to my understanding of this sermon. Yeah, Greg Beale, Don Carson. All right, yeah. You can, but you're doing something, it's not biblical context. Biblical context is my writer making use of the Bible by way of intention. Mm-hmm. So just because something appears somewhere else in the Bible mm-hmm. doesn't mean I make use of it here. We had a great situation like that in the last small group text.
Yeah.
Fan into flame the gift that is within you.
Yeah.
What do I do with that? I'm not preaching to pastors. Ah, but Paul somewhere else talks about spiritual gifts. So as Timothy had a gift, I'm going to preach a sermon that you're supposed to fan into flame your gifts. I don't think Paul has that in mind at all. In fact, I think if you do spiritual gifts there, you're going to unwind what that text is trying to do. Timothy's spiritual gift was preaching and teaching. Your people don't then, by way of principle, because you think that word appears somewhere else, you don't decide that you're going to do this text in that light. No, you would have been far better to leave spiritual gifts in the trash bin and talk about what our congregation needs to learn from this is just as the pastor, Timothy, was to fan into flame the preaching and teaching, and there were things that would keep him from sharing the gospel, yeah. Namely he'd be ashamed of the testimony or he wouldn't want to share in it. Guess what? As it is for the pastor, so it is with the people. Are you not afraid to share the gospel of Jesus Christ with people? Are you fearful of proclaiming the gospel for fear of suffering? So you'd be much better wielding that text to bolster personal witness in your congregation along the lines of what would keep them from it than you would be spiritual gifts, which actually take you out of everything going on in that text. That's why you don't do it. You can talk to me later about other questions, but I'm going to keep banging for a moment. Those are definitions. Let's do a little fun work. I want to do fun work and then a couple of serious things. Let's go to Romans 8, 31 to 39. Let's play the game that you could care less about context. You could care less about context. Find three kitchen calendar verses, and what do you want to do with them? Go for it. Find three kitchen calendar verses and play just the crazy uncle. Do whatever you want to do with them. No consideration of context. All right, somebody give me one. Give me one.
More than conquerors.
More than conquerors. What are you going to do with it? We're going to overcome everything. Yep. Victorious Christian living, which is actually the way Romans 8 was preached for a long time. Now that we have the Spirit, chapter 8, then all of a sudden you see the life of the Christian is this ever onward, upward trajectory that overcomes things. Yep, somebody give me another one. That was the problem with the Keswick movement. But at any rate, somebody give me another one. Is that where is that in Romans 8, 31 to 39?
34.
Oh, you're just hammering on me. Judge not. Oh, are you playing fun with my Keswick comment? Oh, okay.
Who can bring a charge against God's elect?
Okay, who can bring a charge against God's elect? Yep, okay, so don't have
only
to listen.
God can judge.
Only God can judge me. Great one. Somebody give me another one. That shows you how many kitchen calendar verses are in here. I hadn't even seen that one. Yeah, what are you going to do with that? Yeah, yeah. God's for you. Who can be against you? Yep. Which also gets into that conquering theme. Anybody else?
Yeah, verse 32. You know, if God didn't spare us His Son, He'll give us all things.
He'll give us all things. What are you going to do with that?
You can expect all things.
Yeah, you can expect all things. And in every instance, we're the crazy uncle in the pulpit because we're not on the rails. We haven't allowed context. Let's put one of the tools in your hands. I'm going to put literary context in your hands because it's by far the most important of the four. Remember that. By far, it's the most important of the four. Literary context, anything in verses 18 to 30 that would keep you from doing what we just did. Talk to the guy next to you. 18 to 30, anything that would keep you on the rails rather than doing what you wanted. What do you got, anything? What's going on there? Syracuse, what's going on there?
He's talking about, for I consider the sufferings of this present time are not worth bearing, so this more than conquerors victorious life
is enduring the present downside. Yeah, so it almost reframes all that. Literary context in and of itself is going to keep you on the rails, right? It's going to help you there. Let's take another tool. Look at 31 to 39. What other tool do you think you should make use of here to keep yourself on the rails?
Biblical context.
Biblical context, yep. This actually, my author has decided to cite another place in Scripture, so I ought to look it up. So do that with your friend next to you. Look up the citation and see how it affects your understanding of the text or how it would keep you on the rails. You're trying to answer a simple question. Why would Paul cite this text at this time and to what end? Why is he citing it and to what end? How will it enforce my understanding of my text? Okay? Those are always the questions you're asking on biblical context. Why does he cite it? To what end does he make use of it? Anybody? What's going on in Psalm 44?
Suffering.
What kind of suffering? There's a lot of suffering that Israel goes through in the Old Testament. What's the uniqueness of the suffering here?
It's against us, although we have not forgotten.
What verse are you in?
Verse 17.
Everyone put your eyes on it. Read it again.
All of this has come upon us, though we have not forgotten you, and we have not been false to your covenant.
Right. All kinds of times they suffer for doing what's wrong. Mm-hmm. Not here.
Mm-hmm.
It's suffering in light of the fact that I'm just living an obedient life. So, in fact, what kind of suffering here, Paul says? I'm being killed. Now, he's trying to orient a Christian community, really, back to chapter 8. How is it that I now have the Spirit, 8, 1 to 5, and yet I have the Spirit, but I'm ensconced in suffering? And the argument is, suffering is the handmaiden of the Spirit life Christian. And it was like that for you, immediate preceding context. In fact, biblical context, it's always been like that, even in the Old Testament. The righteous do suffer on no account of their own. So all of a sudden, these biblical context, the literary context, really begin to shape how I preach Romans 8, 31 to 39. So all of a sudden now I'm on the rails. Now notice what's happened here. And long for a difference.
Yeah,
that's our prayer, right? Yeah. And while the psalmist calls on God to do this, what does Romans end up doing with this? Just confident sense that he is going to do it. Nothing is going to do it. Back to my little drawing on the ring. Let's just call that prong there literary context. This prong here, biblical context. What they do is they put your text on display. Now, the problem with a lot of our preaching, though, remember I told you we're confused by what it is and by how to use it? A lot of our preaching, we end up preaching the prongs. We're prong preachers. You don't want to be a prong preacher. The prongs are there to put your text on display. The text isn't there for you to put the prongs on display. So what's happening in a lot of our use of context in our preaching is it just becomes more stuff that we want to put in the sermon. And we end up doing a 10-minute sermon on Psalm 44, where as opposed to just grabbing the use for which he threw it forward. So when we preach, a lot of times, gets to context, we do this. This is what H.B. Charles did for me once. Like a dump truck. We're using context simply for more stuff. Or we get so fascinated by all we learned about historical context. I mean, I can talk to you about Rome, and I can talk to you about Nero, and I can talk to you about the temples that were there, and I can talk to you about the prison that Paul might have been in, and I can talk to you about the damp floors and how the wind flew came through, and I can do all of this stuff. And so what? We do information, not impact. So when you start thinking about context, I want you to start thinking about not more stuff, but the significance of the stuff. Not more information, but the impact of the information. And limit your sermonic use to the significance and the impact. And your preaching will actually then allow you to preach your text. And your text actually begins to shine with greater power. Let's look at one more and then we'll take a couple of questions. Go to 2 Corinthians 9:7-9. Notice we're still working in epistle kind of language. 2 Corinthians 9:7-9. Stewardship Sunday. You've got three verses. I want to see the best three-point outline unrelated to context. Ready? Go. And you know what? Why not? I'll get my money out again. Who won the last one? Lonnie won the last one. He gave me my $2 back. So I'm going to try to give my bucks away again. The best non-contextually informed Stewardship Sunday outline on these three verses, 3 points, 1 point for each verse, gets the $2. You got 1 minute. Ready? Go. You non-contextual preacher, you. Read it out loud so you know what you're doing. I know that you're working. Some of you are nodding off. I know you. Read it out loud to your neighbor. Come on, there's a lot of money on the table here. This might get you one wing somewhere. Come on. Keep working. Afternoon session. Keep working. 3-point outline. Verse 7, verse 8, verse 9. Stewardship Sunday. Or if you're a faith-based missionary, this is for your next support letter. Oh my goodness. We got one here. All right, you got one. What do we got?
Give big, give happy, God will give back.
Give big, get happy, and God gives back. Great. Love it. I guess you're doing the God thing from the He will give freely, the quotation. Yep, good. Someone give me another one.
God's investment plan.
Okay.
Give a little, get a lot. Or give a lot, get more.
Good. Somebody else? Mark, you going for the $2? Come on, man.
God like giving, cheerfully, bountifully, freely.
Oh, pretty clean. God like giving. Notice it's God like. Cheerful, bountiful, freely. That's clean, man. You could do that in my church. That's going to work. Anybody else want to take a swing? Dylan, he wants the money. You know, Dylan and Mark are in the same small group, so we got some competition here. Come on.
Pay to save. God will bless those who bless him. Free giving, free life.
That's good. I like it. It's good. Let's take a vote. Who's going for Mark?
Who's Mark?
I like Mark's the best, so I'm giving it to Mark. The freely thing was pretty good. I like the God thing too. True story. Okay, true story. Years ago, I'm preaching through the 2 Corinthians. We were actually doing pretty well in our budget. We got to chapter 8 and 9, and I actually thought, there's going to be a day where we're going to need this. We don't need it now. So I skipped it. Of course, months later, the elders come, go, you know, hey, man, we need a stewardship Sunday. So I go back to it, and I go, I'm ready. I got a sermon. I'm ready to go. Give, verse 7. Get, verse 8. Become like God, verse 9. So I kind of thought, this is going to be easy sermon prep week. And we're going to rake it in. And we're going to be good. But because I had gone to a Simeon Trust workshop, I made the mistake of doing some historical, literary, and biblical contextual work. First, I did some historical work. I ran across Acts 11, 27 to 30 to see the situation and the circumstances to which this was written, which I'm now going to ask you to do. How might that historical context begin to make you question just simply thinking you can do this on Stewardship Sunday without understanding the initial situation of circumstance? Read it out loud to the guy next to you. How might that give you pause before preaching? What do you got? What gives you pause? It wasn't a general offering. It was a special, it was like a World Relief Sunday. It was like there was something going on. I was supposed to collect something. It wasn't for our church budget. Doggone it. It was for those guys on the other side of the world. I mean, we don't have enough to take care of ourselves. I made the further mistake of looking at some literary context. And so literary context, I went to 1 Corinthians 16, 1 to 4. That's broader literary context, right? A letter that's attached to it. And then I went to, within our own letter, 2 Corinthians 8, 1 to 7. How might that have given me even greater pause? Go for it. All right, what do you got? What gives you greater pause? Same thing? So it reinforced my dilemma. There were a couple of other things that hit me too. One was, even when I don't have what I need or enough out of my impoverished state, I'm supposed to be giving to other people. So even just the whole notion of we're short, so let's shore it up. The Church of Macedonia was short, yet they shored them up. Oh, man. Now it's Wednesday, and I'm wondering, what the heck did I get myself into on Stewardship Sunday? The other thing that came up was the 1 Corinthians 16, you take this thing on what? First day of the week. And I'd always gone to my church, and, well, you take the first day. The reason we take our offering on Sunday, first day of the week, they've been doing this from day one, you know, to support the needs of our church. And I realized, well, that's actually, even my use of that way is kind of skewed. Then I made the fatal mistake of biblical context. So there is a biblical contextual clue here, right? Isn't there a verse? Psalm 112, which we had claimed, we related in every instance the three people that related their answers related to this in regard to the character of God. Well, go back and read Psalm 112. I think this is verse 9. And who is the righteous man? Or put differently, who is he who distributes freely? Go ahead. Find that out for the guy that's sitting next to you. Who is the he that's distributing so freely? Anybody find it yet? Anybody find it? Yeah, what verse? Verse 6. It's not God. It's just like, this is what Christians do. Christians do what? It's not like you're going to emulate the character of God. You're just going to emulate the character of an ordinary Christian. What's the characteristic of an ordinary Christian? Well, they give their money to parts of the church and other parts of the world that don't have as much. That's just ordinary life. In fact, they do it when they don't have enough for themselves. So now the question is this, and this happens to me every week. This is why context is so important. Every week I have a decision to make, because I want to preach this idea from a text, but whether it be literary, whether it be historical, what's underneath the text, whether it be biblical, the citation from the text, I have a decision to make. Is the text king? Or am I king? That's what I have to decide every week. Who's king in this church? The text or me? And that, my friends, if you answer that question rightly every week, you're going to be over here. You're going to fight this off. You're going to kill this thing to death. And as a result, you will not be the crazy uncle. You will not be the inebriated preacher. You will be a faithful steward of that which has been entrusted to you. Context, really important tool. It should probably take you about an hour a week to make sure that you're going fast through. Be efficient. Be an efficient preparer. Is my text citing or alluding to another place in the scripture? If so, where? What do I need to look up? And why would he do it? Is the literary context informing my understanding of the text, and how might it control my text? Are there cultural details in the text that were known by the people in the text but wouldn't be known by my listener that I better pay attention to, or they're going to mishear this text altogether? Right? All those things happen, and they should happen for you with energy and force in your study, rather than just sitting around lingering, reading, you know, handbooks and all the rest of whatever it is we're doing when we think we're preparing. And all of a sudden you put that stuff down and you're going to stay on the rails. Take a couple of questions and we're going to take a break. Context, critical tool to spend an hour on every week.